Aye.
Did some work on Heisenberg's uncertainty principle in my PhD work. And I want to tell you about it. And in particular, I also want to give you an idea about what type of work it is that I've been doing, because it isn't exactly what is usually classified as theoretical physics, but it's called, well, depending a little bit on the nation or the language you use, it's either called foundations of physics or history and philosophy of physics. And so I also want to give you some idea about what it is to be doing that and how it slightly differs from theoretical physics, just in the type of questions you ask. So, I'm not quite sure about what you have heard about quantum mechanics yet, or what you might have known already. But I think you are probably familiar with the idea that if you want to describe really small particles like electrons, subatomic particles in general, then somehow you need to describe them sometimes or partly as a particle and sometimes as a wave. And so there is this sort of particle wave duality about them. Does this ring a bell? A little bit? Okay. And this comes about, or this appears in particular, because if we want to talk about, say, the momentum of a particle like that, denoted by the letter P, then this is somehow associated with the wavelength, lambda, of the associated wave, where this is Planck's constant, and the energy is somehow associated with the frequency of that wave. These are known as the de Broglie relations, and of course they were actually first proposed for light. This is also Einstein's relation for energy of light waves. So Einstein associated particles with light waves, and what de Broglie did was just to do to make the converse step, to make things like electrons, which are usually considered as particles, and associate them with waves as well. So this was not something that was peculiar to light only, but to light and matter in general. Now, as you might imagine, so this was due to de Broglie. And I think the year that he did it was 1924. But this was really, really, really puzzling for a long time. And in fact, this is also responsible for the fact that quantum mechanics emerged only very slowly, very gradually, and through the efforts of many, many different people. Einstein's relation, of course, was already 1905, so there's about a 20-year difference between these two developments. And for a very good reason. How on earth is it possible to describe one and the same object partly as a particle and partly as a wave? And there's a really big discrepancy between the two concepts. Particles are usually localized like these. I mean, they're here at a particular space, and they move about in a particular way, and in a way that we can track. But they're always at some place or another. At least that's the classical concept of a particle. But waves are typically not localized. They're spread out. Indeed, they must be spread out in order to talk about particular wavelength. And so how can something be, on the one hand, localized in space and time, and on the other hand, spread out over a large region of space and time? It was really puzzling to use both of these concepts at the same time, and yet see that they were somehow contradictory. And many people puzzled about that. All the founders of quantum theory in particular. And it was somehow due to Heisenberg. To take this all one step further. And this was done in 1927. Actually, when Heisenberg got away from Copenhagen, where he was working at the time because of his hay fever, and went to the remote island of Heligoland, which is just a rock in the North Sea. But at least there's no pollen there, there's no grass, and so he didn't have to sneeze all the time. And he was working there for a long time and in complete isolation. And there he drafted a paper on the following subject. Heisenberg asked himself a couple of fundamental questions, like concerning with the, he said, what is path of a particle? And in particular, if, say, you consider two dimensions of space, a particle might be moving along a particular trajectory. And this is what usually we would consider to be a path. And that means that at each moment in time, the particle has a particular location, which we can denote by its coordinates. And it has a particular velocity or momentum in a particular direction. And so a path is really a conjunction of giving a particular position and a particular momentum at each moment of time. And once you have that, you can reconstruct the entire track that the particle moves to. And this is true not only for billiard balls, but it is true in general. And so in particular, if you would consider an electron as it is moving about in an atom, well, we can't see an electron, but the general picture would be that it somehow orbits the core nucleus of the electron. And the path would look something like this. But all this are classical ideas, and they don't take into account the wave particle duality that I've been talking about. So this is somehow, as you would picture, the path of a particle. But quantum mechanics seems to be incompatible with that idea. So what to do? And now Heisenberg took one particularly radical step at that moment, because he thought, aha, well, maybe if our theory doesn't allow you to picture or describe a well-defined path of a particle, then maybe that is just because such a path doesn't really exist. Maybe it's because such a path cannot even be observed in principle. And so he began to wonder about the question what it actually means to observe paths of particle. And in some cases, you can actually be seeming to observe the path of a particle. For example, most clearly in the case of cosmic rays that were already known at that time. And you can observe rays, cosmic rays, elementary particles, in a sort of Wilson chamber. And I'm not sure if you ever heard of that device, but what you really have in such a chamber is a body of gas, which is super cooled, yeah. So actually that vapor is about to condensate. It really wants to condensate, but it will actually only condensate when there is a particular nuclei or dust particles around, little cores around which the molecules can condensate. And as it happens, it will do that particularly eagerly if there are particles flying about, particularly charged particles. And so if you prepare a chamber of that vapor in this supercooled state suddenly, and you take a picture, a photograph, and there happen to be elementary particles coming from space flying about, what you will see is a track. Left by a cosmic ray. But now, if you look at that closely, what you see, of course, is that that track doesn't consist of a continuous line like pictured over here. It's actually just a number of little dots of condensation nuclei, little droplets of water that are formed where the cosmic ray has passed. And so Heisenberg noted that even in those cases of observation, you don't really get continuous track that I'm picturing over here. You only get a discrete number of blobs, and so you only know the position at certain times, and the velocity is merely reconstructed by drawing the lines in between. So it's like you know one position, then you can say something about its momentum, then you can say something about its position, then you can say something about the momentum, then you can say something about the position, but they sort of interchange each other. And then he thought, aha, actually it doesn't look like you're knowing the position and momentum at the same time. You're only knowing them one after another. So I thought, let's look at that idea more closely. And then he began by formulating a principle that guided this work. He says, if you want to give meaning to the phrase position of an electron. Then you must specify a way to observe it. Otherwise, the whole notion of the position of an electron doesn't seem to make any sense. At least that's what Heisenberg said. So, the question is now, suppose I have an electron, there it is, and I want to start talking about its position. Well, according to Heisenberg, I can only do that if I can think of one particular way to measure the position of a particle. Now, there is an obvious and time-honored way to look at positions in particular small objects, and that is by using a microscope. So Heisenberg said, well, let's try and use a microscope with some lenses and try to look at the electron. Well, the lenses of a microscope are not enough. You also need to eliminate the object. So suppose I have some light wave coming in, and that light will bounce off the electron. The light will enter the microscope, and somewhere behind the microscope you will see a little image formed by that light. And that image is the picture of the electron. And in particular, the position here is correlated here with the position of the original object. So if this one was had moved in this region, then this image will also move. And that's how you can measure the position of an electron or any other object by a microscope or a telescope. But it wouldn't even matter if this was a star and this was your eye. In principle, it's all the same. Is this clear? Good. Now, I've been drawing that image of the light wave here as a little blob as it appears on the screen. And that's because, well, optical instruments are not perfect. And even if you have a point-like source, the image they produce is always a function with a certain width. And that means that there is a limit on how good the microscope will be able to observe position. It's usually called the resolving power of a microscope, which tells you what is the smallest distance, delta x, that the microscope will be able to resolve, the smallest accuracy with which you are able to measure positions. And there's an age-old formula for that resolving power. It is, on the one hand, dependent on the wavelength, and it's also dependent on the angle. Of the opening lens. So this angle here is epsilon. And that means that if you want to have a really, really, really powerful microscope, you should have two things. Firstly, the wavelength of the light you're using should be as small as possible, and the angle of your lens should be as wide as possible. Perhaps some of you will be familiar with that. If you are a photographer, you might know that in order to take sharp pictures, it's always advisable to have a lens opening as big as possible, whereas small lens openings always produce more or less fuzzy and hazy pictures. So that's why this lens angle appears in this formula. Now, as a fact, it happens, Heisenberg was not quite old. He was 25 when he worked on these things. And so this means that he just got his master's thesis a couple of years ago. And it happened that during his examination, people had asked him on his examination about the resultant power of a microscope. And he didn't know the answer. So, and he was quite embarrassed about that. He got through the examination all right, but it was good that he, now, when he was in Heligoland recovering from hay fever, that he actually remembered this formula for the resulting power of a microscope. So, okay, what's the upshot that we got right now? It seems like, first of all, if you want to talk about the position of an electron, you either way can specify a way to observe it by means of a measurement. Well, here is a measurement, but it's only one that has a finite accuracy. That, in principle, is no objection at all, because we can make that accuracy as small as we please. How? Well, simply by using light of a very small wavelength and an angle big enough. So let's do that. Let's suppose that we are talking about really, really small particles. So let's suppose we take really, really, really short wavelength. In principle, we could use the shortest wavelengths we can think of, which are usually called gamma rays. They're even shorter than Rontgen waves, really, really penetrating high frequency, short wavelength form of light. But now, if you want to use that type of light, there was already a quantum effect associated with these light rays, because they're not only just very short wavelength, they're also usually called very hard. And that means, of course, that because their wavelength is so small, their momentum is considerable. And that means that if you picture that light wave as consisting of particles, they have considerable momentum that can no longer be ignored. And this will reveal itself when the light wave hits the electron, because it simply bounces into the electron. And because it has large momentum, it will also give a kick to the electron. So let's now look at that light source as consisting of particles. There may be a photon coming over here, and it has to go into the microscope. And suppose that angle is theta. And that means that after colliding with the electron, its momentum in this direction is the original momentum times the sinus of that angle. That's just a projection on this axis. Okay? That's the momentum of photon after collision with the reactant. At least in the x direction. And that's the only direction I'm caring about. And as I said, it's a really due to a collision with the electron. So if the photon has a momentum in this direction, then the electron will have suffered a recoil in the same direction. And now the crucial observation comes, because what can we say about the direction and the angle theta that a photon has after the collision? Well, we know one thing about it. It must get into the microscope in order to contribute to the image. So the direction of that photon and the angle theta must be smaller than the opening angle determined by the lens. Otherwise, we don't know anything about the part of the proton. It could go this way, it could go that way. We don't even know whether it makes sense to talk about the part of the photon in more precise terms. So the uncertainty in the momentum of the photon let's call that delta px of the photon is of the order of your original momentum times this number. Does that seem reasonable to you? Don't hesitate to ask any questions if you. Yes.
For the theta angle over there, like I don't know if I can't see it, but where is it drawn in? Like on the, is it the same as the E angle? Or is it not?
Yeah, maybe I'll draw a little bit bigger picture here. So here's the lens. Here's the particle. This angle is epsilon. And now this is where the photon goes. And this angle is theta. And the only thing I know about theta is that it can go left or it can go right. But in order to get inside the microscope, the angle should be smaller than epsilon. Okay. Now, I said this is what happens to the photon after it collides. And since it has just collided with the electron, it has given a recoil to the electron. So the electron has changed its momentum, and the uncertainty in how much that momentum has changed is, of course, exactly equal, because there's conservation of momentum, to the uncertainty in the momentum of the photon after the collision. So the uncertainty in the momentum of the electron after collision is also at least this number. And now we can put things together, because this is the original incoming momentum of the electron, of the photons. That's associated with their wavelength by the de Broglie relation. So I get h lambda sine epsilon for the uncertainty momentum in the x direction. And I have this number, for the accuracy with which the position of the electron is known. And now it doesn't take long, because if you multiply those two together to find that this is of the order of Planck's constant. Yes?
If h is zero, so if the photon goes, if h is zero, so if the photon goes vertically up in the diagram, then obviously sine theta is zero. So it's so that means obviously that the momentum of the photon is zero. Is that just because it's being affected by 90 degrees, or is it supposed to be coming in horizontally? Or
it's supposed to come in horizontally here, but actually, really, the direction of the incoming light is not important. So it could come from here. But in this picture, it comes in horizontally. So if theta is zero, that means that the component of the momentum of the photon in the x direction is zero.
Oh, okay. Yeah, exactly.
That doesn't mean that the momentum of the electron is zero. But I've been clever enough not to talk about that. I think not to talk about that. It's only the fact that just because I don't know exactly what theta is, could be here, could be there, it's somewhere in between, that there is a corresponding range of values that the momentum of the electron could have. Even if it's away from zero. But the range of values it could have is equal to the range of values that the photon. Yeah.
Now, for the momentum of the photon, I'm just trying to understand the equation you have there. So it's like you have that PO sine E is the PO is like the momentum of the photon before.
Yeah.
Times the sine of that, the lens angle, right?
Yes.
So then what are you saying that's approximate to? Like, what's that? It was like even further up.
This
yeah,
one. Right there.
Yeah, what's that?
This is. Okay, this is the uncertainty. Mm-hmm. That's delta. In the momentum in the x direction of the photon.
Okay. So you're saying that the uncertainty of the photon in the x direction is proportional to the. The original momentum times the, okay.
Okay. And now, because I don't really, I'm talking here about the photon, but I want to be talking about the electron. So I'm converting that from the photon to the electron. And maybe I should have used electron here
But then the whole location will get so backed up. So here's how Heisenberg got this result. And he immediately jumped to the conclusion that this result is not typical just for a microscope, but that it would apply to any type of measurement you could consider. Each time you want to measure the position of an object, just like an electron, then there is always particular inaccuracy and uncertainty in the determination of that position. And the smaller you try to make that inaccuracy, then the less you will know about the momentum of the particle at the very same instant. And conversely, if you would be trying to measure the momentum of the particle, you could only do that by, at the same time, sacrificing the uncertainty in the position with which you know where that particle is. So, this was the basic message that Heisenberg thought of while he was on his vacation in Heligoland. And he wrote that up. I just said he was working in Copenhagen with Niels Bohr, and he knew that his mentor, Bohr, was a very strong-minded and convinced person. And he also knew that if he would give his paper to Niels Bohr, they would immediately start arguing and discussing. And so he decided to send his paper to a scientific journal just before Bohr got back. Bohr was also on a vacation. And he was right about that, because after he had sent his paper away, Bohr got back and he saw the paper, and they immediately started discussing, and Bohr said, "Oh, you are completely wrong," and started pounding on Heisenberg. And Heisenberg started crying because he couldn't stand all the pressure. And in the end, he wrote a little footnote to the end of the paper saying that Bohr had a couple of good things to say about the whole thing that were really important and that he had overlooked. But let me say one more thing about the point where I started from, because what Heisenberg realized, you can just look at that number, Planck's constant, which is, I don't know, roughly it's about 10 to the minus 34 joules seconds in usual. So it's a really, really, really small number, but on the microscopic scale, it's not negligible. And so if you were to look at, say, the track that you observe in the Wilson chamber, recall that I just said that you're not really measuring position and momentum or position and velocity at the same time. So it's just like you're observing, well, particularly you observe a droplet of water of a particular size, and that's roughly the position of the particle. Then you infer something about the velocity, and then you observe again another position, then you infer something about the velocity, and then there's another position. And all these positions are, well, uncertain to about the size of the water droplets, which is, well, what is it? Size of what, about a millimeter, perhaps slightly smaller. It's smaller, but not much smaller. At least it's huge in comparison to this number. Of course, you can't really compare the numbers, but big enough for a relatively well-defined momentum
to be compatible. But if you want to look at the position of an electron inside an atom, then we're talking about really, really small dimensions, right? Because an atom is maybe 10 to the minus 10 meters. And if you want to look inside that, then you have to determine the position on an even smaller scale. So maybe 10 to the minus 12 and minus 15 meters. Now, if you want to observe an electron, the position of an electron like that, then delta x must be really, really, really small. That means that delta p must become really, really big. And that means actually that if you want to observe the position of an electron inside an atom by using a microscope like this, really fancy, ideal microscope, you've got to hit it with light so hard that even after one instant, the electron will have been kicked out way outside of the atom at all. So really, if you want to observe the position of an electron inside an atom, you can only observe that once. And then the electron is, then the atom is disturbed in such a strong sense that, well, the electron is no longer inside the atom anymore. So you cannot observe more than one position. And keeping with this principle, that means you can't even talk about the orbit of an electron inside an atom because it's not observable. This makes no sense to say how an electron moves inside an atom because there's no way to observe it. You can observe one position, but you cannot observe whether it moves in a circle or an ellipse or in whatever way at all. And this was, of course, a way of thinking that Heisenberg already had a long time, well, long time, 2 years. You shouldn't talk about things that are not observable in principle. So, by using this relation, Heisenberg was able to sort of explain why it seems perfectly sensible to observe tracks of particles in the Wilson chamber, but it's complete nonsense to talk about the orbit of an electron when inside an atom. And that's about all I wanted to say about Heisenberg's original paper. But let me just add two remarks. Well, first of all, how impressive and ingenious Heisenberg's argument was, it all seems to rely on this starting principle of his that you shouldn't, in order to give meaning to any particular phrase, like the position of electron, you must always find a way to measure it. Otherwise, that notion would not make sense. And that is really a philosophical starting point. And one may ask whether you agree with it or not. Does that seem plausible to you? That we should eradicate and stop talking about all notions for which we don't have a way to observe them? I see people nodding their head. Do you think that that's something that's ubiquitously agreed upon in physics? Yeah?
For example, make a prediction of a particle, let's say for about a trillion, which you haven't observed, but which makes sense to assume its existence. And then later experiments will show you that it actually exists.
Okay. Well, I think I can give Heisenberg some credit. He said he didn't say you must already have observed it. You must observe it now. But in principle, there should be some way to. And so even in the case of neutrinos, which are really, really hard to get hold of, yes, they were predicted. And then only later, with much effort, people found ways to actually observe it. But I'm thinking of something else. Even more recently, there's a whole host of elementary particles, not just electrons and neutrinos. But what about quarks? People believe nowadays that even the heavy particles like protons and neutrons are composed of other particles called quarks. And they play an important role in modern theories, like the standard model. However, nobody has ever been able to observe the quark. In fact, there's a theorem in the standard model that says that you can't isolate single quarks. They're always accompanied by other quarks. This is called quark confinement. And so it's impossible, as the theory itself says, to see a single quark. Does that make this concept of quarks useless?
No. Just be,
yeah?
No, let's say just a model, we imagine they exist, because it's better for us to describe it that it exists, and our correlations are easier to say that they exist. But we have to say that we have no experimental evidence that they really do exist in nature, and that we can just take it as a mathematical model.
Well, that's a good and useful point of view. And indeed, there are many people who would agree with you, because you say, well, we talk about quarks, and it seems like as if they exist, that they're a very convenient mathematical fiction, but don't be certain that they also exist in reality. So that's one point of view. And it's, as I said, it's a perfectly reasonable point. There are also people who say, no, look, like, we've got our fundamental theories. The theory says that they exist. Maybe we're not completely sure by experiment whether they exist, but they could exist. And as long as something can exist, then it certainly has a meaning to say. And then there are people who take the same point of view as Heisenberg and say, no, it's complete useless to talk about things that you can observe. So actually, you shouldn't talk about them at all. And that means that, well, if you are strict, perhaps more strict than Heisenberg was in his best days, if you look at the standard model, you should erase every time the word quark appears and replace that phrase by something that only refers to observable notions. And so, well, what I'm trying to say is, I'm not trying to give an answer to the question that because there is no unanimous answer to it. I'm just trying to tell you, trying to show that this is really a philosophical point. Whether physics should concern itself only with observable point views or not. Yes?
But what about the wave function? I mean, you can never really observe the wave function because the
Wave
function will collapse. Therefore, is it a mathematical model? or does it really exist? And if it really exists, then this is that doesn't work with Heisenberg's view.
I think I fully correct to say that according to Heisenberg and Bohr, that wave function doesn't really exist. I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But I'm just, for the moment, say, I'm just, well, here's something. The Heisenberg's principle. Is a philosophical one. And, well, what I mean by philosophical is at least that it's debatable. You may agree with it, or you may not agree with it. And what usually happens with philosophical issues is there are good reasons for both sides. Same. It's not like a physical question who is against it, yes or no, and true or false. And there's another point that I also want to point out. Because, well, even if it's remarkable that Heisenberg's conclusion was, he really, really, really is also sliding short about certain issues. Notice that I started out talking about the position of the electron. Then I started also talking about the momentum of the electron. And in the end, I come to a conclusion which is perfectly symmetrical between position and momentum. But I really haven't thought much about the question what it means to talk about the momentum of the electron. And if you want to take Heisenberg's principle serious, actually there should also be a way to give observational meaning, in a sense, the momentum of the electron. And now, actually, there's something very weird. Puzzling happening here, because we're talking about the momentum of the electron as it is after a collision with a photon. So we're really thinking of the momentum of the electron as being disturbed by a kick of the photon. And now, and here is the weird question. Does it make sense to talk about something being disturbed if that something is not really well defined, if we don't know how to give meaning to it? Yeah. If you think there is no such thing as the momentum of the electron, or at least not the precise momentum, then how can it be disturbed? I think you can only disturb things that have meaning. And Heisenberg doesn't really talk about that issue at all. And so what you basically see in his paper and in his subsequent work is that Heisenberg sort of equates uncertainty, which really only means that we don't know what an exact value is. A lack of meaning. Which indicates that there's really no sense to be talking more precisely. Not just that we don't know it. Experimental inaccuracy. Indefiniteness.
and indeterminacy. And so on. And actually, you can see this paper using different words. I think there are about 14 different words that he has for uncertainty that he uses as different parts of his paper. And he shifts between them all the while, and so has everybody else since then. And so there's really, and that's also the big puzzle of that still exists in the interpretation of conservatism. Does it merely say something about that we cannot exactly know the position of the particle and momentum? But we might be silent about the question whether it still has position and momentum. Yes?
We spoke about the strong interpretation, the weak interpretation. So either it is the nature of a particle that you have this uncertainty, or is it because of your experimental accuracy? What did Heisenberg himself believe?
Heisenberg thought that this was all different sides of the same coin. And he wasn't, as far as I can tell, he wasn't really interested in distinguishing. And because of course, this principle already says that if you cannot observe something with sufficient accuracy, then he is prepared to say, well, then the whole concept has got meaning that's more precise than that inaccuracy. So it's really not only experimental, it's ontological, because it refers to properties the system has, and it's also logical, in the sense that concepts are not simply defined more precisely than by this particular term. Yeah?
I know that it isn't properly incorporated into quantum mechanics, but all these particles have mass.
Yes.
So
except for photons.
If we had a sensitive enough meter, couldn't we measure the change in the gravitational fields and infer their position from there?
Well, you quite correctly pointed out that quantum mechanics, as it is today, and certainly as it was in the 1920s, had no means to talk about gravity. But I'm certain that even if you would devise a way to measure the position of a particle, measure the position of a particle by measuring its gravitational field, that would also, in the end, incorporate some type of effect by which momentum is influenced in such a way that you're circulating. And actually, it didn't take long for people to find a general relation that can be proved according to the principles and does not rely just on this particular example that Heisenberg thought of. So that's actually what I will try to talk about next. I'm really talked for now. But I also want to say slightly something about the historical context. Because you might know that Heisenberg, as I just said, quantum mechanics came about very slowly through the effort of many different people. And for a long time, progress was really, really, really slow. And people were thinking of all types of models and approaches. And one approach was
started and then was left out, and then another approach came about, and then it was found out to be hopeless, and then another approach. And so it went on for years and years, until just 2 years before Heisenberg was thinking about this uncertainty. In 1925, Heisenberg, he found the first general theory to deal with quantum phenomena. And that was a theory which actually doesn't quite look the way that we think and teach quantum mechanics nowadays. But it's somewhat similar to what I'm just saying, because Heisenberg took the point of view that actually you should only talk about observable quantities. And all these ideas of the preceding generations and people who've been talking about models and trying to picture some way of how electrons move in atoms, finding orbits and the like, that all this was nonsense, that it was completely lacking in meaning, and that you should simply stop trying to visualize what an electron looks like, or how it behaves, or how it moves. And the only thing you should be concerned about are the quantities that you can observe in measurements. Now, when dealing with atoms, and particularly at those times, all the things that you could observe about atoms are the particular stationary energy levels in which electrons could exist in atoms. And you might know perhaps that this is typically Bohr's own work in 1913, his model of the atom, is that an electron may exist at a particular stationary level and then it can jump to another level if it absorbs a little bit of light, or it can jump back to a lower level under the emission of a certain amount of light. And really, that's all we know about what happens inside an atom. And the question how it jumps from one level to another is completely open. Bohr had nothing to say about it. That was just something that was beyond his theory. And so Heisenberg adopts the same point of view. He said, well, the only things you can observe are these transitions between various levels. And if this is level, it's a discrete level, so it can be numbered by a particular real number, and the other level also. And so the only things you can observe are quantities associated with these various levels, which are sort of indexed by these two numbers of the initial and the final atomic level. So there's no talk about orbits or how an electron moves. You only talk about, say, the energy that comes from an atomic transition and that can be observed by the light that the atom gives off, the characteristic frequency. And so Heisenberg started playing around with numbers that depended on two integers and that can be ordered in a square array. So you take n, and both n and m are variables. And all these numbers can take different values depending on the values of n and m. And these square arrays of numbers were already known by mathematicians at the time, although Heisenberg didn't know about that, but they're called matrices. And you can play around with them, and you can particularly, you can add them, and you can subtract them, and you can multiply them. And they have some strange properties, particularly because multiplication isn't the same. Depends on the order in which you multiply it to make.
And I don't want to go too deeply into that. But that's how Heisenberg found his first theory. And it's called matrix mechanics. Yes?
That non-commutable objects were essential.
Well, that must also have been in 1925. And I think that actually, well, Heisenberg found the starting ideas. Heisenberg, however, wasn't very well acquainted with the concept of matrices. And so he only found out the non-commutability of the matrices in the course of his expeditions. And it was only actually after he joined up his forces with Max Born, who was older and much better educated in mathematics, and Born knew that something about matrix theory. And Born was also the first to write down the commutation relation. And then they published a joint paper together with another person called Jordan, and so famous three-man paper, 1925, that announced the matrix mechanics. Do you have a question? Now, the funny thing is, so this was the first formulation of quantum mechanics, and it's called matrix mechanics. And the main point I wanted to note is that it starts from sort of similar principle that you should only talk about observable quantities. And I also want to note that it has nothing like wave functions or any type of these relations in it at all. That actually is due to development that appears just after Heisenberg found his matrix mechanics, and it's due to a man called Schrödinger. In 1 year later, he developed the versions of the theory, which was now called wave mechanics, and it started from a completely different point of view. It was Schrödinger who tried to visualize an electron as a sort of oscillating cloud, a sort of wavy cloud that could oscillate and was charged, and so it was a density spread out in space, and it was characterized by a wave function. Moreover, just like de Broglie had done before, but Schrödinger went further and even found the equation, the wave equation, which described how that wave would evolve in space and time. And so, well, I'm just trying to say how completely different it was. Heisenberg said, you should not try to visualize what happens inside in an atom, because it's not observable. You should only concentrate on these transitions. And even if these transitions are discontinuous in time, so the jumps, and don't try to make any thoughts about how an electron goes from one state to another. Schrödinger, on the other hand, said, well, you should try to picture what an electron looks like. It's a wave. And it doesn't jump. It moves steadily and continuously, oscillating according to my beautiful continuous wave equation. There are no jumps, it moves. And you can describe how it moves. And you can visualize the whole thing. And therefore, you don't need to consider matrix mechanics. So they were in complete opposition. And yet, turned out, funnily enough, that the two types of theories that they were developing were mathematically completely equivalent. And Schrödinger proved that about a half a year after he gave his image. And, well, you can imagine how they reacted to each other. I mean, Schrödinger really, really, really disliked Heisenberg's matrix mechanics because of his, all of his jumping. And Heisenberg, on the other hand, really disliked Schrödinger's point of view because he thought this was really very childish to go back to pictures and try to visualize what was going on inside the neuron. And, well, they talked to each other. Schrödinger was invited to Copenhagen, where Heisenberg was working, together with Bohr, and they talked about him a lot, about the whole thing a lot, and Schrödinger. And I just said how forceful Bohr could be. Well, he was even more forceful perhaps with Schrödinger, because he talked and talked and talked and discussed all the other things with Schrödinger. And Schrödinger fell sick, became ill, and so he was put in bed, and Bohr's wife was feeding him chicken soup all the time. And every time she would come into his room with another bowl of chicken soup, then Niels Bohr would put her hand, but Schrödinger, you must admit at least this, this, this. And in the end, Schrödinger also collapsed and said, well, if all this quantum jumping is here to stay, then I will be sorry that I ever got involved with the whole thing. I would rather become a cobbler or a shoemaker than a physicist. But really, I'm just telling this also because it was really the competition with Schrödinger that made Heisenberg think more closely about what it means to observe a particle. Because the main thing that attracted people to Schrödinger's point of view is, of course, the idea that these wave functions are really visualizable and that matrix mechanics is not visualizable. And therefore, he wanted to give a reason, an intuitive reason for why it was not visualizable. Really, it's getting already rather late. Well, let me try to go a little bit further and also talk about the mathematical expression of the uncertainty relation. And you can do that by taking a look at another example that you also is due to Heisenberg. This is from a little later, but suppose you have a slit, a screen with a small hole in it, and there's a wave, front coming in with a very well-defined wavelength or momentum, and it impinges upon that screen. And now what happens, and maybe you already know that from wave optics, is that after the slit, that wave will start to diverge, goes into different directions. And if you have a screen very far away, then there's a particular pattern that will arise there, and it's roughly something like this. And this intensity of the light on the very distant screen is actually also a good measure for the direction in which light goes after the slit. And this may be an approximation little bit, but very good approximation under usual conditions is that if you simply suppose that the particle goes in this direction and this angle is, say, alpha, and this distance is y, then the direction I'm always talking about, directions in this direction, and so the momentum in that direction is really just given by the original momentum times sine alpha, which of course is two good approximation y over L, where L is distance. Between the screen and slit. Now, can that help to illustrate the uncertainty relation? Well, yes, because if there's a well-known fact that the smaller you make that slit, the more it resembles a pinhole, the wider this interference, this diffraction pattern becomes, the more spread out it becomes. And that means, because of this association between the momentum and the direction on the screen, that the more uncertain the momentum has become here in this red direction. Whereas if you make the slit wider, then the beam will be more focused moving forward. And so the uncertainty in the direction, the transverse direction of momentum, becomes smaller. And so it seems to be a illustration of that same relation that I talked about. Good. Now, let's try to talk about that more in terms of wave functions. They're actually, I'm not quite sure how familiar you are with this idea, but in quantum mechanics, and you can associate a wave function with both in position x and in momentum. And so this is the x direction, and let's think of the wave function of the particle as it is in the slit. And then, at least to a very good approximation, this is the slit width. That wave function will be just actually drawing the absolute square of that wave function, will be given just by rectangular function. There's also a particular wave function for the particle in momentum. And let's denote that by phi. And that function, well, it's actually, I just said that what you observe on the distance screen is a very good approximation for the distribution of the momentum. And yes, it has the same shape. So if I draw it absolute square, then that's actually something like sinus of p, where it should be normalized, so that is
is the function. And so, yes, you can see that relationship holding, because if you want to make this one narrower, then this function must become wider, because if you look, say, at this distance between the maximum and the first minimum, and you will see that that's of the order pi of a. And I actually put Planck's constant equal to 1 in this formula. Otherwise, I would have had to add that somewhere. So it's really also of that sign. But it's not really important. Now, what I wanted to say is really the following. It is a perfect example or illustration of the uncertainty relations. But there's also a question of how to express that relation in a general form, because Heisenberg's original argument was sort of hand waving. It used an illustration. But as you also perhaps might have noticed, he didn't use any exact mathematical definitions, even of what he meant by an uncertainty. And this was later filled in, actually, a couple of months after Heisenberg published the paper, by another man called Kennard. And let us define as the root mean square of position, and similarly for momentum. But this is just the average position. And this is the average of the square of the position. And this is the root of the square deviation of the position. It's actually, apart from the fact that I'm using wave functions, it's a very well-known statistical concept for spread, called the root mean square. And if you take these two mathematically well-defined concepts of uncertainty, then you can show that for all wave functions, this relation holds. And this was, as I said, due to Kennard, also in 1927. And that is now a mathematical theorem, whereas that relation is just a qualitative rule of thumb. So this is the relation that physicists have since used as the mathematical precise version of the uncertainty relation. However, and this is perhaps slightly funny, and also shows you what it means like to do work in foundations of physics. Try and apply that relation to the example I've just been talking about.
And it's not hard to find the root mean square deviation of x for this function. And sure enough, it's of the order of magnitude of the width slit. However, if you look at the root mean square deviation of this particular distribution function, you find something funny because it has tails that fall off only very, very slowly. They vanish. Well, the sign, of course, stays of the order of magnitude 1. So every time it has a maximum, the size of that maximum decreases by a factor of p, 1 over p squared. But in this formula, we're going to multiply that with a factor of p squared. And integrate it all over the range. And so what will happen is that delta p diverges. Whereas delta x is, well, roughly of the order of a. So what happens if I multiply a with infinity? I get an infinite number. Is an infinite number larger than Planck's constant? Yes. This relation is still true. Nothing wrong with it. However, does it say anything about the width of the diffraction peak? No. Delta p isn't even sensitive to the width of the diffraction peak because it's completely dominated by these small but very long tails. So the relation is true. But does it actually say that whenever you make the slit smaller, the diffraction, the width of the diffraction pattern must increase? No, it does not. Because it's insensitive to the width of the diffraction pattern. And delta p would be infinite regardless of how small or large the value of a is. It doesn't tell you anything. So that's the point. The mathematically exact and precise definition that has been universally accepted by physicists as the precise expression of uncertainty relation actually is too weak to be applied even though those examples that Heisenberg was discussing. And perhaps you might still see it, but in the microscope, you have that same pattern here. So if you applied that definition of uncertainty there, you would also find infinity. Now, my time is up, and so I can't really talk about things going on. But of course, as you might guess, this leads to a further question. Because what Heisenberg is trying to say seems to be correct. And this is also correct, but it's not strong enough to express what Heisenberg is trying to say. And if Heisenberg is really correct, then apparently there must be other relations, other definitions of uncertainty that are stronger than the root mean square deviation and still also satisfy an inequality of this type. And that's the type of work I've been doing in my dissertation. So I've been trying to find other relations of this kind that are actually stronger and are good enough to base off all the examples that Heisenberg and Bohr used in the discussions of Newton today. And all I can say at this moment is, yes, they exist. So Heisenberg need not be in trouble, but this particular form of incentivization is not good enough for his own purpose. Yes?
Is that the final equation of an equality of whatever and again? Because
could you repeat the question?
The equation that we got was delta x, delta p is greater than or equal to h over 4 pi.
Yes.
Get that from
there. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, an h with a bar through it is h over 2 pi.
Oh.
By convention. And sorry, it's something that I got so used to it that I forgot to mention it. So, this is time for the next stop.
Okay.